This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Hey, Junkians, welcome back to Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. Dot mastery. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good, it just has to be fattening. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he's a lieutenant of Megaforce, he is someone who I would happily count as a friend for the end of the world, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going?
I'm excited.
Because of Cargillvember?
Well, it is still, as you know, Cargillvember is trucking along. And one of the things some of you have heard of us talk about is the fact that for a while we've been wanting to resurrect Junk Food Masters.
Yep.
You know, modern Junk Food Masters. We were trying to figure out how to do it as a month. And we just, I was like, you know what? Let's just do it as once a month. Let's just do a different master and just talk about great filmmakers who are working today who don't necessarily get all the due that we think they will, you know, have, you know, 10, 15 years down the road where people
sure.
look back and go, oh, yes, they were a master. And since this is Cargillvember, I got a chance to go ahead and pick out someone who is quite literally one of my favorite working screenwriters and a fantastic director, just an amazing director, Laureen Scafaria.
Yeah, no, this is really interesting because this is someone that I actually wasn't aware that I was aware of.
Yeah, no, and she's somebody who isn't, you know, she isn't somebody who gets mentioned a lot when people talk about a lot of modern directors. Of course, you know, this is a problem that Hollywood has, is it just doesn't, it marginalizes the various female screenwriters and directors and doesn't give them as much props as you would get. Like, this is something that, you know, people talked about where, you know, you get Colin Trevorrow who comes out of Sundance with a movie and all of a sudden it's like, here's a $200 million franchise and here's a Star Wars movie. And, hey, we're taking that Star Wars movie away because we saw your third movie. You know, you get those things that happen. Doesn't really happen with female directors.
Right.
And that's something that needs to change. And it's something that is going to change because a bunch of us are, you know, starting to be louder about it. And we're going to see to it. One of the most talented women working in Hollywood right now is Laureen Scafaria, hands down. And you are familiar with her films, whether you've seen them or not. And today we're going to talk about the three films that she wrote, two of which she directed.
Absolutely. And for those of you who are unaware of what Junk Food, Modern Junk Food Masters is, you can go back on iTunes and Stitcher, and that's, well, Stitcher as well, but Blog Talk Radio's catalog and find our previous episodes where we talked about people like Joe Lynch and Adam Green. We talked about
James Wan.
We talked about James Wan. We talked about Ernesto Diaz Espinosa. We talked about, you know, these people who make movies that are fucking phenomenal that for whatever reason.
Adam Wingard,
Simon Barrett, you know, people that make these movies that a lot of times Cargill and I and fellow geeks see at film festivals who don't always get, but are starting to get, as Cargill mentioned, that mainstream push. I mean, Adam Wingard, for fuck's sake, is doing...
He's making a Godzilla versus King Kong movie.
Come on. Like, that's fucking huge. And James Wan obviously crossed over into the Fast and the Furious dimension, made his amazing Haunted House movies.
Joe Lynch has Mayhem blowing up right now.
So excited
Adam
to see
Green
that.
Is going around with his new Crowley, Victor Crowley.
Yeah.
That is getting amazing reviews.
So, yeah, absolutely. And just to kind of poorly segue, speaking of blowing up, if you want to see a hockey arena blow up in spectacular fashion, I would highly recommend that you go, if you live in Austin, go to Alamo Drafthouse, South Lamar on December 5th at 7 p.m. Junk Food Cinema presents Sudden Death as part of what we announced last month. December will be, in fact, kicking off JCVD-cember. So I am super excited about that. And remember to follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show, I highly, highly recommend, no, I beseech you to go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, which is a way for you to directly financially support the show and ensure that it keeps going well past the end of the world. So that again is patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. So let's dive back into this. Lorraine Scafaria, the reason that I knew but didn't know that I knew Lorraine Scafaria was because of Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist.
Yes, which is, that's where we're going to start.
Not again.
This is Nick. He's a sensitive musician.
I'm not going.
We have a gig, Nikki.
I'm taking a mental health day.
Who's bad at relationships.
Hey, Tris, it's Nick.
You know, I think we both said some things we didn't mean, like when you broke up with me on my B-day.
This is Nora.
Okay, everybody in.
She always plays by the rules.
You have to promise me that you won't get drunk tonight.
But tonight...
Nora, alone again?
I came here with someone.
Who?
She's going to break them.
Would you be my boyfriend for 5 minutes?
What?
Please, just go with it, okay?
Nick, Nora, how do you guys, like, know each other?
We're the same dentist.
Yeah, he's good. I gotta get my friend home.
We'll take the drunk mess home.
Yay!
You two go have fun.
If you touch one hair on her head, I will kill all of you.
Nora, I'm being carried.
Ow.
Oh, she'll be okay.
We sort of lost a girl.
What?
What? Ah!
I found Jesus.
What?
Jesus!
He's much taller in person.
Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist.
This is a movie that has become one of my go-to travel movies. It is the very first movie I bought digitally. It is at the very back of my Amazon queue. It was on sale for like $5 one week, and I'm like, I really love that movie and I would rent that, so let me just go ahead and buy it. I have put it on my iPad. I have never removed it from my iPad.
Yeah.
I have so many great movies now that come and go. Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist is always on there because no matter what airport I'm stuck in, no matter what plane I'm on, I can be sifting through that list and there's Nick and Nora's and I can be like, yeah, I'm totally going to fucking watch
it. Which makes a lot of sense because it's very much like if you have a playlist that you travel with that just it gives you all the right feels as you're traveling and really puts you in the right mood. That's kind of what this movie is for that.
Well, and as many of you know, one of the genres that Brian and I completely 100% agree on is one of our very favorites is the all-in-one night movie.
Yeah.
And that is what this is. This is two people going into New York City over the course of one night and the crazy adventure that ends up happening as a result.
And I think that, by the way, this is 2008. This stars Kat Dennings and Michael Cera. Michael Cera plays, if you can buy this, now go way out on a limb with me. He is a schlubby kind of hipster kid who is getting his heart broken, doesn't know how to deal with it. And so this girl who's been messing with him, he is just distraught over. Meanwhile, Kat Dennings plays a girl named Nora who doesn't know Nick, but has, by friendship with the girl that is breaking Nick's heart, keeps coming across these mix CDs that he keeps making for the girl that's breaking his heart that she throws out. So Nora is like, this guy's amazing. He makes the most amazing mixes. I don't even know who he is, but she's already kind of got feelings for him based on his music selections, because this is, and this is a sort of caveat emptor situation, one of the most hipster movies I have ever seen in my entire life.
And rightly so. It is a movie that, you know what, one of the things I've come to love about this movie is this movie literally straddles the line between two different eras and defines the era that came before it. I feel like, as much as we've talked about how Predator 2 is the waiting room for the 90s, it is as much as Tango and Cash is literally the last movie to come out in the 80s, Predator 2 is the last movie of the 80s. This is the last movie of the aughts, even though it came out in 2008. There is this line of demarcation in 2007 when the iPhone came out, where all of a sudden smartphones changed our world. And this movie was written and made before the dawn of the iPhone, to where this movie doesn't know that iPhones exist. And this movie is a reflection of that world that came before it, where MySpace is still a thing and Facebook and Twitter haven't really happened yet. And in fact, Twitter didn't exist yet when they made the movie. It had just happened in summer of 2007. This is a movie to which social media is not connected. Listening to the radio is still a big thing. Phones get texts and calls, and that's it. And yes, this is that movie. Now,
I'd be interested to read the book this is based on that was published in 2006, because I'm wondering how much of that had it. Because as you mentioned, the iPhone, the smartphone really blew up in 2007. So
here's what I really want to get into. Every great writer has one thing they do better than every other writer. That's just the way writers, you know, tend to work. They have something that they excel at that nobody else does. And what Laureen Scafaria does better than any other writer is that she is an expert at taking two cliches, two characters that are just such common tropes that we are tired of them, that you can describe them in two words and totally nail who they are in these movies. And then she goes and instantly she makes you kind of dislike them.
Yeah.
They do things in the first act that make you go, oh God, they're these people. But she endears you to them enough that you care about them. And then she peels the onion. And she peels the onion. And by the time you get to the third act, you are in love with these characters. These cliches have become three-dimensional. They are not cliched characters. Like, we're talking about the fact that, like, here's a stretch. Kat Denning plays a hipster. And Michael Cera plays a hipster.
Oh, by the way, he's in a band that's not quite taking off. Can you believe that?
Yeah. And you look at, when you lay them out, it's one is in fact, referred to in the movie as a Jewish American princess who's a little rich girl, hipster girl. And then you get this character who's, you know, this hipster kid in a band who's pining for this girl who broke his heart. And the first act of this movie is these characters starting to hate each other.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so first of all, let's talk about the brilliance of how this movie opens. This movie opens in which the inciting incident of this movie is the first kiss. Now, that's the climax of this kind of movie. It's a romantic comedy. They're not supposed to kiss in the first 10 minutes of the movie, but in minute 14 of this movie, and that's totally by accident because they did reshoots. By the way, the opening of this movie where you see them at school and you see them, you know, see Michael Cera talking,
leaving that awful voicemail,
leaving a terrible voicemail, all reshoots added later. The movie actually, as written, opens up at this concert, opens up at the jerk-off show. And so this movie opens with them being thrust into a situation and them kissing, and you see that instant spark. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, where the fuck is the movie going to go from there? Well, these two hipsters annoy the shit out of each other by saying all the things that hipsters get annoyed by. And there's this great conversation while they're in the car where she's like, oh, are you straight edge like me? And he's like, well, I don't really subscribe to labels. And your eyes roll so far.
I'm looking for the ejector seat button at that point.
Yeah, well, they both are. And that's the thing, is they both say things that annoy the other. And they're like, oh, shit, how do I get out of this car?
Which, I gotta point this out now. It sounds like I'm shitting on this movie, but here's the brilliance of Laureen Scafaria, is that, as Scargill mentioned, her ability to endear you to these characters, despite the fact that these are archetypes that are like right at the top of my list of people I want to punch in the face.
Oh, and all six characters we're going to talk, all six protagonists we're going to talk about over the course of the next hour, all fit into that mold. Like, we're going to describe them right off the get-go and go, oh God, it's this character. I hate that character. And oh, wow, did they really cast the person who is the stereotype of that? And then she fucking knocks it out of the park, and you fall in love with you are going to love all six of these characters by the end of these movies. You're just going to love them, and you are going to feel for them, and they're all three-dimensional. She does not put fucking two-dimensional protagonists in any of her work. They are all fucking amazing, which is why I am mystified by her work. She's so good at this, and how she draws it out of these tiny little fun character moments, and how you don't see the track that she's laying. You just end up there. It's so masterfully done. And Nick and Nora's is where you see the first hints of just how brilliant she is. Because, man, do you get these characters. And, man, are they fun. And wow, the setup of this, I don't know how much of it comes from the book, is really kind of fascinating. You know, the fact that here you have this straight kid playing in a gay band. And I love how progressive the movie is, because that is not an issue.
Nope.
Like, it's not a thing. It's a bit for jokes, but the jokes are all good. And if you've ever spent time in the gay community, they're really funny fucking gay jokes. Like, they're the gay jokes that the gay community makes. They're not making fun of the gay community. It's how the gay community jokes, and it's fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
You get this great sister motherly relationship between Kat Dennings' character and her best friend Caroline, which something that you don't actually, that something that comes from the book that doesn't come across in the movie, is she's Jewish.
And she's going to a Catholic school.
Because Caroline keeps getting kicked out of schools for her behavior, and she follows her around the schools because she's always got to be going to school with Caroline. That's the best friends they are. And so when Caroline gets lost in the city,
in the city, really?
Yes, okay. Really.
All right, they just checking.
They have to chase her down and track her down, and they keep losing her.
It becomes the Adventures in Babysitting, where she's like, literally, she's stuck at the bus stop, the bus station.
By the way, the connection, because all of Cargill-Vember is connected, where, you know, last week we had the connection to Spice World, where
the Meatloaf connection.
Meatloaf connection. This one, there's a Spice Girls song that features prominently in this.
I noticed that.
In this movie.
Can we, by the way, the Meatloaf connection needs to be the mall food court storefront that we open. Up, we will find a way to make that shit work.
Someday we'll find it.
The meatloaf connection.
The lovers,
the gravy, and me.
But yes, so this movie is a great single night movie. It is probably my favorite single night movie in terms of favorites. I don't know how many times I've watched this. In fact, I felt like, you know what? I don't need to rewatch this for this episode, since, you know, we're not going a full hour into this. And I ended up fucking watching it anyway. I stayed up an extra hour and a half and went to bed really late, because I was like, fuck it, I want to watch this movie again before I talk about it. Because I just love this film, and I love every beat of this movie. There's not a part of this movie I dislike. There's just, it's so fun. And it sets up the model for what we will talk about over the next three movies, the next two movies, which is, every single one of her films is a movie in which two characters think they know what they want at the beginning, and like a good road movie, end up finding something completely different. And the ending is completely unexpected and not what these characters wanted, and instead is what they really wanted.
See, and I'm glad you mentioned the road movie element, because what I've found is that Lorenzo Cavarria is the rom-com version of David Ayer, because so many of her stories, so much of her work is about the road trip. It's about two characters thrust together. It's about two characters you could originally in act one describe with one sentence, but they're almost always on a road trip together. Like, it feels very much like a ride along, a David Ayer ride along, except it's romantic.
Yeah. And in this one, they spend the entire movie trying to track down Caroline and trying to get to find Where's Fluffy, this mythical band that's playing.
Playing a secret show, because...
By the way, well, that's the thing, is this is one of those movies, it's an I Love New York movie. It's like,
oh, for sure.
My city is magical and I love this city.
How many times are specific cross streets mentioned in this fucking movie?
Constantly.
And like, it's into the minutiae of New York City.
If you spend any time in New York City, you're like, oh, I know where that is.
Which I haven't, so I'm like, I don't fucking know where that is.
Yeah, no, I, when we made Sinister, I lived in New York for like 2 months, and I like just on 80th and first between second. And so I spent a lot of time walking and catching cabs because the subway terrified me. So I didn't know how it worked. So I wasn't, I don't understand this. Worked. Now that I've, you know, spent time in London and did the tubes for 4 months, I'm like, oh shit. Yeah, I can do a subway. I understand subways now. But yeah, so it's very much an I Love New York movie, but also I love the up and coming bands of New York in this era. So all of this music is out of this very particular scene. And you can definitely, there are moments where Bishop Allen just shows up. Why? Because Bishop Allen was always playing in New York at the time. And this, the, you know, by the way, the music in this movie, Mark fucking Mothersbaugh, Holy shit. Another great Mark Mothersbaugh. For those of you that don't know who Mark Mothersbaugh is, you probably at this point know him chiefly as a music producer, some guy who, you know, a guy who does, is a music supervisor for movies. He did Yo Gabba Gabba, which is how a lot of kids and parents now know him. But he was the lead singer of Devo. And Mark Mothersbaugh is brilliant and a sub genius. For those of you who are familiar with the Church of the Sub Genius from back in the day,
he just likes Das Boot a lot. Or
no. Okay. The Church. We'll do a whole thing on one of these days. Apparently. Maybe I'll show you Arise. And
whoa, hey, put it back in your pants.
No. Arise was a thing for the Church of the Sub Genius. Anyhow, long story short, the music in the movie's fucking fantastic.
It really is. As is the. By the way, we haven't even mentioned the fact that. There's a fuck ton of cameos in this movie.
Oh, God, yes. And such a great cast. Jay Baruchel plays, you know, the ex-boyfriend. You've got – why don't you run through the cast list of cameos in this thing?
So, yes, Jay Baruchel's in this. We also have Seth Meyers making out with Lorraine herself.
Yeah, Lorraine.
Yeah.
In the backseat. Yeah, they think it's a cab.
By the fucking way. You mentioned that this movie a lot of this work is affected by the creation of the smartphone. This movie invents Uber. Fucking Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist invents Uber, guys. Because there's a running gag in this movie that because he drives a yellow Yugo, everybody thinks it's a cab. And all these drunk people keep
it's
trying to get in.
It's not a cab, my friend.
It's not a cab, my friend. And then Seth Meyers and Lorraine herself get in the car and are making out with each other. And they're like, we want to go to this ballroom. And he's just like, he knows there's no point in kicking them out. So he's like, okay, fine. And they get there. He's like, how much do I owe you? $8.50. And you get him like, oh my God, stranger picking them up. They thought it was a cab. It functioned like a cab. And then they just paid. This movie invented Uber. Before there was Uber, there was Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. I was blown away by that. We also have, speaking of SNL, we also have Andy Samberg playing...
Little Bird.
Whoa, playing a way too affectionate homeless man. And then Mike...
No, I love that scene because he's not really that affectionate. He's trying to scare the guy off, but not being scary. He's trying to creep the guy out because they're just trying to fucking sleep. And this guy came up, so this douchebag hipster came up and woke them up.
Mission accomplished. We also have John Cho as a hype man at one of the clubs.
The guy who introduces Are You Randy and then shows up voice-wise at the end to introduce Where's Fluffy, which kind of ties in the whole fact that Are You Randy and Where's Fluffy are in on the gag together. Like, if you've never noticed that about the movie, like, they get pissed off when Are You Randy comes out. John Cho introduces Where's Fluffy later at a different show. I'm convinced that that's the gag, that the whole thing is like, Are You Randy is the bait and switch, that they always have a fun time, and that Are You Randy might actually be a member of the band.
Yeah, that would be a really hipster bullshit thing to do. So I buy that.
But yeah, so John Cho.
And then my fucking favorite cameo in this whole movie is Kevin Corrigan.
Oh, yes.
As the guy at Port Authority with the turkey sandwich who decided
on the day not to do any of the dialogue.
His fucking character choices. I'm not going to speak.
And so they had to ad lib. But that scene is fun.
It's so fucking hilarious. And yeah, and then we have Eddie K. Thomas as Jesus.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a great scene where a drunk Caroline looks up and says, I'm sorry, I have to go. I have to follow Jesus. Who a lot of you probably know him from Scorpion right now is his big show that he's on. He was also Finch in all the American Pie movies. But he's great as Jesus in this movie. And actually a character I was really happy to see turn up, an actor, Aaron Yu, who I loved to pieces in the Friday the 13th remake. And I haven't seen him in a lot of other movies. So I was like, yay, Aaron Yu is in this as well. It's a fucking stacked cast, which as we move into our next movie, will be a theme as well.
Oh, yes.
There's a lot of great cameos. But in this movie, yeah, there's a lot of great cameos in our next movie as well.
Yeah, let's move on. Yeah, no, absolutely. If for some reason you've never seen Nick and Nora's, for fuck's sake, watch Nick and Nora's.
And I will say,
it is the romantic comedy for people who hate romantic comedy.
And I will say this, a big feather in the cap of this movie, the thing that should make me hate this fucking movie more than the hipsters, more than the I knew this band before they were famous bullshit, it's called Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. To the balls on these writers who wrote this book to fucking call upon Nick and Nora Charles from the Thin Man movies.
Yep.
Like, if you set that up as, oh, this is what we're playing with our romantic leads, those are some giant shoes you just threw down, and I'm going to expect you to try and fill them. So
the really kind of funny little insidious in-joke to that is they're Nick and Nora, but they don't drink.
Neither one of them drink.
They're both straight edge. Neither drink. They're high school kids that don't drink. And that the whole movie is set off by their drunken friend who is closer to Nick and Nora Charles than they could ever be.
True story.
Nice meeting you.
Our next movie, actually, this is the one that I was most excited to watch for this episode because it's one that had been on my shortlist for a long time because I don't know if you guys know this. Like, this might be a well-kept secret. Cargill and I really like post-apocalyptic movies. We like
The End of the World.
We really are fans of The End of the World. And this movie is actually called Seeking a Friend for the End of the World from 2012.
And this is the Loreen's directorial debut.
The final mission to save mankind has failed. The 70-mile-wide asteroid known as Matilda is set to collide with Earth in exactly 3 weeks' time, and we'll be bringing you our countdown to the end of days, along with all your classic rock favorites.
So, feel free to wear your casual Friday clothing pretty much any day of the week. And if anyone wants to be CFO... anyone?
So, what are you doing with the rest of your life?
Catching up on some me time, find God, maybe move around some chairs.
Maybe I'll run into you on orgy or something.
That sounds nice. Listen, Elsa, you don't have to come next week or ever if you don't want to. It's okay.
You fighting me?
There's just no need. Forget it.
See you next week, Mr. Dutch.
I regret my entire life.
Okay.
Bye. Bye now.
We should set up Dodge with Karen, don't you think?
It's everything I never wore.
The sky is falling. I've been with a different girl every day. They don't care about diseases. Are you gonna call them back? Or are you related? You know?
No, I don't. I don't. Hello? You okay?
No! I'm never gonna see my family again.
Would you like to come in?
I won't steal anything if you don't kill me.
Agreed.
We're on the road to nowhere.
Tony, don't be serious.
How fast are you going?
15 miles an hour over the speed limit.
Given the... couldn't you find it in your heart to give my friend here a fighting chance of being with the one he loves before we all reach our untimely conclusion?
No.
This movie is fucking phenomenal.
It really is.
It's a movie that sadly just came and went. A lot of people didn't really notice it in 2012. I saw it the night it came out because I was really excited to see it. And man, oh man, oh man. This this is starting to replace Shawshank Redemption in terms of movies that if I run across it in anywhere, I have to fucking watch it.
Oh, gotcha.
When I'm up and I start sifting through the queue and I see that Netflix has it or Amazon Prime has it and I'm sifting looking for something to watch and I'm like, oh, they have Seeking a Friend for the End. All right, fuck it, I'm watching that. I just instantly stop on it and just watch it. And every time it's like resume and it's like, no, motherfucker, I'm watching it from the beginning. Start from the beginning.
By the way, Sifting the Queue would be a great podcast title.
Yeah, it is. It's just become one of those movies. I can always watch this movie. I will never get tired of this movie. And it's very much like Nick and Nora's that way, but it's a very different film. So the two characters that you hate in this one, first of all.
Hey, Cargill, who do we hate?
Who do we hate? We hate cuckolded husbands and manic pixie dream girls.
Yeah.
And that is who this movie is. This movie, if you have not seen Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, oh my God, this movie is a junk food cinema must.
Yeah.
It opens up with Armageddon having failed.
Yes.
The movie
on the
opens
radio.
Up with a close up of a radio. They're listening to the radio. They're in a car. And we find out that Armageddon has failed. 90 seconds into the mission, the U.S. space shuttle has been destroyed. They don't know why. All hope for Earth is gone. And by the way, an asteroid is going to slam into the planet in 3 weeks and we're all going to die. And that's the setup of the movie. Instantly, what happens is we see a shell-shocked, cuckolded husband and his wife just looks at him in shock, opens the car door, runs off into the park, and we never see her again.
Now, it's important to mention that we keep referring to him as a cuckolded husband. That's actually a end of the first act reveal that I think is very powerful because at the start, you just think there was something wrong with their marriage. She couldn't deal with the fact the world was ending and she just took off. And then we actually learn in what I thought was a really powerful scene, because so what happens is, you know, Steve Carell playing this character named Dodge, his wife runs off. He crosses paths with the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, played in this movie by Keira Knightley, who they live in the same building, but they've never really talked. And there's a great moment where Keira Knightley says to him, oh, yeah, I think I saw your roommate and her boyfriend. And he's like, my roommate? And she's like, yeah, he used to come around a lot. I don't know if they're still together. And he's like, my roommate and her boyfriend. And you realize that, like, his wife had been having an affair.
And had been having an affair in front of the neighbors.
Yeah.
And didn't care. And he just never noticed. And this is, and again, this is what I'm talking about. Like, he is an oblivious, cuckolded husband. Like, he is exactly that character in every other movie that you'd fucking hate. And yeah, with Steve Carell playing him, he would be, you know, a nemesis. He'd be obnoxious like he is in The Way, Way Back.
Yeah.
Where it's deliberately done that way. And so you, but instead, wow, holy shit, do you fall in love with him? Holy shit, do you fall in love with her? And she, again, like, here is everything about, you know, this is a side character from Nick and Nora's playlist. Like, she's obsessed with her vinyl.
Oh my God.
She goes through guys like tissue paper. She's, as she says, a serial monogamist. Like, she doesn't sleep around, but she falls in love and then falls out of love and moves on to the next guy.
Yeah.
And of course, we have her boyfriend in this one.
Adam Brody.
Remember this for a moment, because this is going to be very important very soon. Adam Brody, who was dating Laureen Scaparia at the time. So she put her boyfriend in the movie. I'm not certain if she hired him for this and they dated, or if they dated beforehand, but I know that they had a relationship. That's going to be very important here very soon. Stow that little factoid away.
Put a pin in that one. And more than his marital issues, if I can call upon the unfiltered fiance again for just a moment, the thing that I really had a problem with, because we keep mentioning that Lorraine will introduce you to characters that you initially hate, is she, Lauren was watching this with me, and she just watched Steve Carell for about 5 minutes and went, ugh, he's such a sad sack. Cheer the fuck up. Just because the world's ending. Ugh. And I was like, yeah, that's kind of my issue too, is he's just such a fucking sad sack.
Well, it's almost a softer version of Joe versus the Volcano.
That, she said that same fucking thing. That's so crazy.
It's not as drab and depressing as that, because it's funny. Because the jokes in this fucking movie are so fucking funny. Like, they're jokes that are consistently funny, that you've watched the movie a dozen times and you're still laughing at those jokes because they're just great jokes. You know, you have, people are committing suicide. There's this great scene at the beginning where he's at a work meeting and there's this woman just sobbing. And there's this guy who completely is trying to be as positive. He's like, hey, there's some new human resources wants to let you know that there's some new positions in upper management that are available. Does anyone want to be chief financial officer?
And nobody takes.
Well, because there's literally the entire company's fallen to shit. He sells insurance. He's that guy.
I love the funniest joke about that to me is that he's still going to work at all.
And then he goes to the greatest end of the world party ever.
Yes.
Where what they've done is collected a whole bunch of great, some of the best comedians working in LA right now, which I'm convinced she got to, you know, I don't know where she got to know them, but she did work on it. She wrote an episode of Children's Hospital, which some of
that
you
that explains Rob Hubel in this movie and Rob Corddry as well.
Explain TJ Miller.
Oh, I forgot. Yeah.
Most of the comedian cameos, it's like, oh yeah, she did an episode of Children's Hospital. Of course she knows everyone in that comedy scene.
So at this party, we have the likes of Amy Schumer, Melanie Lynskey. We have Rob Corddry, as we mentioned. Connie Britton's in here.
Patton is in the fucking movie.
Patton
fucking Oswald. Yes. With the greatest delivery of the greatest line in this movie.
What I love most about this movie is that for all of our Mad Maxes and all of our battle trucks and all of our Exterminators of the Year 3000s is and 1990 Bronx Warriors is.
But you guys know we fucking talked about constantly for all four seasons of this fucking show.
This movie is so much more authentic to me about what would actually happen if the world were really about to end, because these people treat it like it's the greatest vacation of all time. They make a reference to it, and that's exactly what this is. Everyone's fucking bucket list getting checked off one hedonistic thing after another.
It's summer camp. It's like,
yeah.
And that's what this party is. It's, you know, these adults are together. There's kids there, and they don't give a shit. It's like, yeah, you're never going to grow up. You're never never going to grow old. Fuck it, drink.
Yeah. I love they're giving the kids booze. That's so fucking funny.
You know, somebody shows up with heroin. Who wants to do heroin? It's like, oh, bucket list. Like, they're doing everything. People sleeping with everybody. Like, people just don't give a shit anymore because there is no future. We're all going to die. And that's it. And it's so great. And it's so funny. And that is the world we live in. And watching how all of these characters that we run into deal with death is what this movie's about while we go on the road trip.
The road trip, because one of the things that's been happening is that Keira Knightley has been getting all of Steve Carell's mail. And when she finally gives him that stack of mail, once they start talking, inside is a letter from the girl who got away from him in high school saying, "You were the love of my life."
Played by?
Played by Lorraine Scafaria.
Yeah. So she's the one that's gotten away. And so he decides, shit, I should go and find her.
Yeah.
And so Keira Knightley feels so bad because she's had this letter for like 3 months. She feels so bad about this that she agrees to take him to go find her. And he agrees that if she takes her, that because they've closed down all air traffic, he knows a guy, he used to know a guy who has a plane and who might be able to fly her across the Atlantic to England, see her folks.
Yeah.
Because she misses her parents and that's her driving force, is that she misses her family. She went off to become the Manic Pixie Dream Girl to live the life and realized that she fucked up all along and she should have stayed home with her family because that's who really mattered. And so that is her journey. And then they go on the road together and run into a whole cast of even more fucking great character actors.
Yeah. This does not take place over one night like Nick and Nora's, but it has that same sort of
it's got the 90s road trip quality.
It's got that Corvette Summer kind of thing where it's just like, or Pee-wee's Big Adventure, where it's just like, we're going to a place, things are really wacky, and we keep encountering all of these crazy characters, and it's...
How great is Frenzies?
I love that. Oh, Frenzies. I want to eat at Frenzies every night of the week. Like, this is my favorite part about this apocalypse, is that people don't know what to do, so they keep just going to work. And so they show up at this restaurant called Frenzies, and all of the waitstaff is clearly taking ecstasy, and they're like, "Whoa, we didn't know you'd be open." He's like, "Yeah, we thought about closing down, but then we were like, fuck it, we're just gonna keep coming to work. Is the booth okay? Because we burned all the chairs in a bonfire.
Yeah. And then an orgy breaks out. And it's this play, you know, do you have mudslides? Yes.
Dude, hats off to Gillian Jacobs from Community, who is their waitress in this scene and is so fucking hysterical.
Yeah, her and TJ Miller are fucking hilarious together. Like, that's the thing, is so you keep walking into these great set pieces. You get they end up running out of gas, and so they get into a car with Grissom.
Oh, William Peterson himself, who, hilariously, it is set up to make you think he's a serial killer, which you see William Peterson, star of Manhunter, as a supposed serial killer. That was fucking funny.
And how that scene plays out is fucking fantastic. And there's just great character scene after great character scene until we, you know, end up getting to the resolution of the movie, which is, again, fucking beautiful. Like, it is everything you want out of a movie. Once again, our two characters don't get anything that they set out to get, but they get exactly what they really needed and what they really wanted.
And this has, much like Catch Me If You Can, one of my favorite things in cinema, which is third act sheen. Third act sheen is my favorite sheen.
Third act sheen's pretty great. I don't know. I think President Sheen is my favorite Sheen, but third act Sheen is my second favorite Sheen.
Sure.
But yeah, no, when he shows up in the movie, he's just fucking great. And his relationship with Dodge is just so interesting. And that's the thing is, again, here you're seeing Loreen's hallmark of taking two characters that you would ordinarily hate in the movie, and by the end, you just absolutely love them. They're so fleshed out, but there are all these great smaller characters along the way and all these scenes of dialogue. It never feels like she's laying track or like she's giving you exposition to explain things. It always feels like you are just in the moment of just a great movie, and then it's like, oh shit, that was all set up and I didn't see you setting that up. That was just so masterfully done. And all of these small little bits give us everything we need to get to this amazing fucking third act. And by the way, the music choices in this fucking movie, holy God.
So good.
Just so great. They're so mellow. They're so, this movie, again, is another movie in love with music. You definitely see Scafaria's connection to music in this movie. And it is just really so elegant, so beautiful. If she never made another movie, this would be her masterpiece. I have a feeling we're going to get many more masterpieces out of her just by all the magic of this movie. This movie's so great.
I want to highlight one scene in particular in this movie that completely broke me. Is there's a scene where they need a new vehicle and they get dropped off at the house of one of Keira Knightley's exes, played by Derek Luke, who, speaking of the 90s, or the early aughts at least, Derek Luke plays this character who set up a bomb shelter and he's convinced that they're going to survive.
He's a survivalist.
He's a survivalist. And we're introduced to him wearing a gas mask doing pull-ups. It's like so perfect. And there's a scene where she has a satellite phone and she calls her family and just listening to her end of the conversation and her like bittersweet elation at being able to talk to them and just moving from relative to relative, and Steve Carell's watching her. And apparently, and I don't doubt this for a second, according to the IMDb, Keira Knightley made the entire crew cry as she's like performing this scene, because there was just so much joy and heartbreak at the same time in every conversation that she has to be ad-libbing or improvising to a certain degree at least. And just it's so sweet and so sincere. And it's at the heart of every Scafaria movie, where it's like, yeah, you get characters you're supposed to hate, situations you might not glom onto, but the sincerity and the deep affection that these characters are able to pull from you and how endearing they end up being. To me, for this movie, that scene is it. That's that moment.
No, that's the God, it's there's so much heart in that scene.
Absolutely.
And it's a rough moment in that scene. And that's the scene that makes you forgive all of her loopiness. Because the thing is she really is, she does play by the Manic Pixie Dream Girl hallmark.
So hard. So hard.
You know, but I love the fact that they make her broken as a result of it. Like she's really dysfunctional in several ways. One of my favorite moments in this movie is the scene where she knocks on the window and she just needs to talk to someone. It's how her and Dodge, you know, have this first meet and have this conversation. And he's like, "Do you want to come in?" And she's like,
"I won't steal anything if you don't rape me."
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's like such an end of the world kind of scene where she's just being honest. But at the same time, it's like, God, that is exactly what that does set up a really interesting dichotomy of, you know, the male female relationship in this era, where it's like, oh yeah, those are the two things that you'd be worried about at the end of the world with this. That's kind of fucked up. And yeah, then
for sure
they connect after that and in such a sweet way, and then ultimately become who they become by the end of the movie. And it is just, God, this movie's so fucking well done.
So I have a proposal for you. Carpenter has his apocalypse trilogy in The Thing, in The Mouth of Madness, and oh my God, why am I blanking? Oh my God, why am I blanking? Fucking
Prince of Darkness.
Sorry. I want to propose the comedic apocalypse trilogy with This, Zombieland, and This Is the End. That is the comedic apocalypse trilogy.
Yeah. If you want to sit down and have a great night watching the end of the world, watching three different fantastic views of it, that's the way to go. Although I'd say that this is the best of them.
I think
this is character-wise
construction.
Funniest.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite of those three is probably going to be Zombieland, but in terms of character and construction, yeah, I think you're right, 100%. And that brings us actually to the final movie we're going to talk about in the Scafaria catalog, which is a movie that I had actually never even heard of, not once, not come across it in any way, shape, or form.
It got a limited release, which is criminal. Fucking criminal that it got a limited release. I'm a big Scafaria fan, as you can tell already, and I didn't know that it had come and gone in theaters. Like, I had missed it. I was busy working and when it came out last year, and so I didn't know. I had missed it and had to wait for it to come out, and then the night it came out on VOD, I, of course, instantly watched it. And, man, what a fucking crime that people don't know about the meddler.
Laura. You're not bringing the mail?
Jesus. Mom, you have
have to ring the doorbell.
But I've got the key.
How do you feel since your husband died?
There are a lot of hours in the day, and so sometimes I call Lori.
I brought you bagels.
You should have called.
I did,
but I didn't answer.
You let Daddy's bonsai die.
You can't just leave someone with bonsai and orchid.
You let the orchid die too?
I think we should get you a hobby.
Or maybe you could be my hobby.
I have to go to New York for a few weeks.
New York?
I leave tomorrow.
Tomorrow? If I go with you, I could be like your assistant.
No.
Marnie, what are you doing here?
You said you needed a babysitter. I brought bagels.
Mom, don't talk to my friends.
What you have to do is have him tip you upside down. That's what Joe and I did to conceive Lori.
Call me and let me know you've gotten safe.
Oh, and remind me to tell you what your therapist said. How do you take a selfie?
Who are you sending a selfie to?
Ooh. Ooh. I'm not talking about it.
Who are you texting?
You need to have sex with someone and you can't be here for it. I still need a ride to the airport.
In fact, here's the thing is we, you know, as you guys know, because Brian has become a new dad recently, we've been recording two episodes at a time every 2 weeks. So this week we had, you know, four movies that we had to do as homework. And so I'm like, all right, we're watching Leap of Faith. We're watching, you know, you had already seen Nick and Nora, but I knew you'd watch it again. You know, I definitely knew you'd love Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, but I was like, the meddler's the one he's not going to dick.
That was your wild card?
That was the wild card. I was like, you know what? I don't know if you're going to connect with this one, but I had this feeling in me because you have this connection with your dad and you've just become a new dad.
Yeah.
And I was like, maybe there's an outside chance that you're going to fall in love with the meddler the same way I did. And did you?
What's interesting is it didn't sink into me what you were saying about Scafaria giving you characters that initially you're not supposed to like. Because I didn't initially like Susan Sarandon's character in The Meddler.
She's an overbearing mother.
Yeah, and to the point that it was just like, it was just exhausting. And actually, more than that is it exhausted me to watch a character be so willingly taken advantage of over and over and over again that I just, it started to really grate on me and weigh on me that I'm just like, oh my God, I can't watch this. And then I realized it's like she went from being this overbearing mother who I didn't like to somebody who made me not like this movie because I was tired of seeing her. And it started like the wheels started turning. I'm like, why does that upset me? Oh, because I actually like her and I'm tired of seeing people take advantage. Holy shit. It was like this weird Kaiser Soze moment where it's like, oh no, she's made me like this character all of a sudden.
Yeah, no, and you fall in love with her. And then, of course, the other protagonist of this movie is her daughter, played by Rose Byrne, who starts out playing, you know, the damaged, broken artist who doesn't want anything to do with her mother. And so, you know, and in the first few scenes seems very whiny. And of course, as all the information comes out and upon, you know, I've seen this movie several times now, plays very differently once you know everything that's going on. But that's how you meet, you know, you've got the broken artist and her overbearing mother. Here is why we asked you to put a pin in something earlier. This is Scafaria's most nakedly autobiographical film. Like, this movie is entirely about her. This is, and I didn't know anything about her life when I watched it. I knew, you know, her work, but watching this movie as a writer, I was just like, oh, this is way too authentic. Like, there's details here. There's threads here. This is autobiographical in some way, shape, or form. And so I then, you know, hit the Wikipedia and hit online and read interviews and such like that. And I was like, holy shit, this whole thing is autobiographical. Her dad passed away a few years ago. She had a very hard time dealing with it. Her and her mother had very interesting results in it. While at the same time, she's dealing with her big breakup with movie star Adam Brody. And they were dating, they broke up. And so this movie is about an overbearing mother trying to get over the death of her husband while trying to connect with her one of three children, who the other two children seem to be doing fine. This is the child she wants to be close to help out, who is dealing with the breakup with her movie star boyfriend. We find out, you know, slowly we see that this woman's a writer. And then slow later in the film, we're like, oh, she's actually a writer and a director.
Yeah.
And then it's like, and she was dating a movie star and he left her for his assistant. And it's like, oh, wait, this all sounds a little too.
It's a very, do you need me to leave for this type of moment where it's like, should I be here? Should I be seeing this? But yeah, you're right. It's very naked. And I think the moment where the serpent starts eating its own tail is when, I mean, the basic story here is that, yes, Rose Byrne plays a writer-director whose boyfriend leaves her for his assistant, and her mother, whose husband has just died, leaves New York and moves to L.A. just to be closer to her and kind of doesn't respect boundaries and is just very much the meddler.
Kind of doesn't at all respect boundaries. She uses bagels to disrespect boundaries entirely.
So, but it, what ends up happening at one point in the movie is that Rose Byrne happily, you know, takes a job on this TV show in New York to kind of get away from her mom. In fact, doesn't tell her about it till the night before that she has to leave to put some distance between them. And my favorite scene in this movie, in this entire movie, maybe my second favorite scene, is when Susan Sarandon, as the mother, shows up to the set of this show and you watch the show being filmed, this comedy, and you realize that the character in the show is her. Is entirely Susan Sarandon.
And that the husband is entirely her father.
Because
and her husband, you know, Rose Byrne's father.
Let's stare into the mirror.
Played by Harry Hamlin.
Yes. Let's stare into the mirror at the mirror here, because we have a writer-director writing and directing a movie in which a character writes and directs a show about. It's like next level meta autobiographical.
Yeah, it's play within a play.
Yeah.
Like, and it's fantastic. It is, yeah. Hey, this, here's an autobiographical film about making an autobiographical TV show.
And it just, and you know, it was one of those armchair psychologist things where I actually beat the therapist character to the punch in this movie, because it's like throughout the movie, you know, when Rose Byrne doesn't
Captain psychology degree,
when Rose Byrne doesn't want to hang out with her mother goes and kind of just involves herself in other people's lives in Rose, you know, that Rose
Byrne's
looking
for knows. Human connection. She's looking to fix something.
She starts using money to fix everybody's problems, and you see it left and right in this movie.
And here's the essential thing that we haven't mentioned yet is Susan Sarandon's husband has just passed away. And by just, we find out shortly after that it was 2 years ago,
yeah.
But has left her independently wealthy. He ran a great business. And so she's got money coming out the wazoo. And so she can literally just throw money around. And so she does.
Yeah. And it's like a great example is there is a character played by, there's some SNL alums in this, including Cecily Strong, who plays this friend of Rose Byrne, but they're not super close because Rose Byrne's like, I don't want to go to her shower. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. And so Susan Sarandon ends up going on her own, hearing that she can't pay for her wedding and just pays for this woman's entire wedding.
What's her name?
What's her name? Yeah.
what's her name's wedding?
Jillian, what's Jillian? And the therapist says, what's Jillian's last name? And she's like, it starts with a G, or it's a consonant. It starts with a consonant. And the therapist says, like, do you feel guilty about all the money that you inherited from your husband? And I'm like, yeah, she fucking does, because she's giving people rides. This is the part that really pissed me off in terms of people taking advantage of her is when the guy from the Apple store, who she's been given a ride to junior college, brings his brother along, and the brother's like, I need to make a stop. And it's a fucking drug deal. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, Susan Sarandon, like, you can't save all these people. Like, you've got to stop doing this. And then the fucking cops show up and she's got to eat all of the marijuana that was left. It's like, oh my God, you people are treating Susan Sarandon like shit, and it's pissing me off.
Yeah, but she wants to be. That's the thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, she, and I really, really, really love the scene immediately after the drug deal where it's like, why don't we stop for ice cream?
Yes.
Immediately cuts to them eating ice cream.
She's having so
the greatest
sweet.
Time. Cause she is. And, there's that again, this is one of those movies that just sneaks up on you that you think it's about one thing. And then it's really about something completely different.
Well, yeah. And I love the fact that even though she wants to help all these people, when it comes to her love life, she then uses all of these things as an excuse to never get close to anybody. Like, Michael McKean's got a great role in this movie as a single dad that somebody's trying to set her up with. And every time he broaches the subject of let's have lunch, he's like, oh no, I got a dog sit, and then I might be, you know, volunteering at the hospital. Whether she's actually doing it or not, she's using these things to kind of distance herself. And then there's a great, the fucking amazing J.K. Simmons in this movie playing a cop who's trying to get close to her, and they have this obvious chemistry, but because of the hang up she has about her husband dying and, you know, what them and you know, hanging onto the ashes, and like when they start to get really close and how she backs away from that, and you know, that it's just, it's really fucking interesting.
By the way, something that needs to be pointed out, there's this TV show, Netflix show called Frankie and Grace, and Sam Elliott.
Grace and Frankie. Yeah.
Sam Elliott makes an appearance on the show. And at one point he's on, you know, they're looking at him on Facebook, and one of them says, "Oh my God, there's only 10 men in the world that can pull off that mustache, and he's 9 of them."
The other one, this is J.K. Simmons.
J.K. Simmons is the 10th one who can pull off that mustache. He takes Sam Elliott's mustache and uses it with aplomb.
Hey, Cargill, the first Justice League trailer, ask me who I thought was playing Commissioner Gordon.
Sam Elliott.
I swore, the voice and the mustache, I'm like, oh my God, Sam Elliott. And then I looked at like, no, no, it's J.K. Okay, that's fine too, but I swear to God. And then in this movie, his voice, I'm like, there is something very, the two of them need to play retired buddy cops. Like, that needs to be a movie that happens.
Only if they can both have sons, and one of them is Thomas Jane, and the other is
Aaron Eckhart. Oh, call it the duplex. I am so on board for that.
There we go. There's our comedy.
That is so much nitro I'd have to put back in a box, though. Like
so much nitro in the box.
It's like Sorcerer 2, Electric Boogaloo. That's so much nitroglycerin.
Back in the box. But, yeah, so... So what this movie's really about, and what I love about this movie, is you think it's, you know, you think it's the meddler. It's about mom coming to grips. No, it's about them both coming to grips. They are both absolutely distraught by the death of the father, you know, Susan Sarandon's husband. It's so wonderful when all of that gets revealed that the daughter is not broken up about this boyfriend as much as she's broken up about the loss of her father, and that she's been trying to deal with it. And the reason why she can't deal with her mother isn't that she doesn't love her mother. It's that seeing her mother reminds her of her father, and she does not want that. She cannot take that. And you see her trying to cope. Her mom shows up, and what does she do? She goes and fucking hits the pipe and, you know, gets stoned because she can't fucking deal with it. And it's all there. And then finally, the climax of this movie is a mother and daughter sitting on the ground in a bedroom crying and just crying and admitting to each other that they haven't gotten over it.
After a really great gag where Rose Byrne thinks she's pregnant, has Susan Sarandon buy pregnancy tests, it comes up positive, and she's like, I'm actually really happy, and you know, we're going to do this.
And those seeds, by the way, are all seeded through. Like, you have to, like, you actually... You know, when mom goes and looks at her computer to sneak, you can actually further down the list of her browser history see that she's been Googling adoption.
Yeah.
And that she wants to become a mother and hasn't found the guy because she's still hung up on this fucking, you know, asshole who ran off with the with his assistant. And as a result, you know, she wants to start a family.
Yeah.
And so when she finds out she might be pregnant, she actually gets kind of excited. She's like, oh shit.
Yeah. And my favorite moment of the kind of the other side of the scale, where you realize her meddling is actually improving people's lives, when she actually does start volunteering at the hospital, there's a woman that she sits with all the time. And this woman has this strange habit of kind of pointing up in the air ET style and just making circles with her fingers. And Susan Sarandon, for most of the movie, thinks she just wants her to turn on the TV. And then she figures out what she's doing and she goes and gets a rotary phone and puts it in front of the woman. And the woman calls her son, and the son shows up. I was like, "Mom, I had no idea." I fucking wept.
Yeah,
I was like, "God damn!"
That scene is that's the tear jerking moment in this scene where you're like, "Oh fuck!" He's like, "Mom, I didn't know," and you're like, "Oh my god,
man!"
Oh, and her bed is just covered with littered with stuffed animals at that point because she's constantly bringing stuffed animals.
Yes,
because again, that's how she knows how to show love, is spending money. And it's, and I connected with this film quite a bit because, you know, Susan Sarandon is very much like my mother, like this, you know, who her mother is really. Reminds me very much of my own mom. And so I'm like, wow, this is authentic as fuck. This is a New York mom. My mom's an upstate New York mom, but Jesus Christ, it's the same fucking mom. Oh, by the way, we got to talk about some of the cameos in this film.
Oh, because
again,
100%.
The cameos. Oh my God. First of all, someone I'm shocked we have not talked about more on this show. Shocked. we have not spent, because he's someone who we would probably put on the Mount Junk Food. Robert fucking Picardo. Picardo shows up briefly as one of the Italian brothers in this and is fucking great.
I had a, speaking of the cameos in this movie, I had a weird moment watching, I was watching, it was the same movie. And there's a woman in, who's one of the bridesmaids, who I was like, where did I just see this woman? I was like, oh, she had a bit part in an episode of Fresh Off the Boat, which I've been watching a lot of recently. And about the moment that clicked, who else shows up in this movie? Randall fucking Park. From Fresh Off the Boat, it shows up in the movie as well. We already mentioned Cecily
Keene,
Cecily Strong, Jason Ritter is in the movie. Who else? Just a lot of fucking great cameos in this movie, left and right. So here's a question for you, Cargill. Harry Hamlin, we also mentioned.
Harry Hamlin, and who's playing the mother in that scene? It was another. Actress Laura San Giacomo.
Oh, correct. Yes.
Makes an appearance in the sitcom.
So here's my question, Cargill. Since we're talking about themes in Scafaria movies, who's the music hipster in this movie? Because there is one.
Oh, it's Mom.
I actually was going to say it's J.K. Simmons. He's like, no, my chickens only will lay eggs to Dolly Parton.
The touch. Well, yeah, there's the Dolly Parton, you know, music in this movie, but Mom is obsessed with Beyonce.
That's true.
And has the whole running Beyonce thing and is always listening to Beyonce.
So this is like the older Nick and Nora getting together. They're both weird music hipsters.
Music plays an important part of all three of these movies.
For sure.
Like it is, you can tell that Scafaria has a love affair with music, that she has a connection with music, and her music taste is fucking great. I don't know how much that played into Nick and Nora's, but I definitely know it played into, you know, the two films she directed, and man, does she have great fucking taste in music.
Absolutely.
And sure enough, the Dolly she picks is fucking great. The whole chicken thing with Dolly is, fantastic. The whole ending of this movie with what happens with getting arrested and how all of that plays out.
I love the line, did you only bail me out because you're an officer of the law? And he goes, no, that's actually in a lot of ways the opposite of what I do.
But then again, you know, we haven't really talked about that because we focused on her structuring and her character development. Scafaria's a witty fucking writer.
Yeah.
She's so fucking witty. Like the jokes are always smart jokes. They're always character driven. She doesn't really go for the cheap gag. The only cheap gag in any of her films is the gum from the first movie from Nick and Nora's. Which, by the way, the more times you watch Nick and Nora, the more you realize the gum goes on an adventure as well. Like you can actually track the origin of the gum from the guy it first comes from all the way through to the end of the movie.
If you have that kind of time, you absolutely can do that.
I've watched this movie enough that I've actually had a watch through where I track the gum. That might have been a thing that I did on a plane one night. Look, I fly a lot.
Speaking of Catch Me If You Can.
You know, I'm a novelist and a screenwriter. I travel a lot. And so I end up watching this movie a lot because it literally is one of my favorite travel movies. And I did have I did actually do the gum tracking watch through.
The
gum, by the way, you can actually track it all the way through to the end of the movie.
Follow the gum.
I know you're not my birth mother, but will you please be my earth mother?
What? I want to go ahead and jump to our junk food pairing, which...
of course you do. Well, so anyhow, overall, I got to say, I'm so happy. You had not seen these last two films. You were not aware of her work. I'm so glad that she is now on your radar.
Yeah.
She needs to make another movie fucking pronto. I need to see another fucking movie from her. Because right now, so far, she's put out a movie every 4 years. And that is criminal. It is criminal that it takes every 4 years to get a movie out.
She's a leap year director.
I do not.
But she didn't direct Leap Year.
Yeah, no. I do not want to wait till 2020 to see my next Scafaria fix. It is, she's brilliant. She is literally one of my favorite working screenwriters, period. It is, and I, you know, that is, I'm putting her up there with, when you say you're putting her up with Tarantino, yes, I'm putting her up with Tarantino. Like, she is so fucking good. She is so A-list. I admire and marvel at her work. And if you have not seen any of these films, if you've not seen one of these films, see all of them, watch all of them together, and watch how she does it every single fucking movie, how she takes those two characters and you go, oh yeah, the beginning of this movie, she's unafraid to make us dislike these characters, and then she makes us fall in fucking love with them. It is, and always surrounds them with lovable characters. That's what's so interesting, is she, every single one of these movies, she is surrounded by characters that you just fall in love with. Even the jerky ones are likable. Like even the obnoxious people at the party at the end of the world, you still fucking love.
Yeah.
Like it's, they're just fucking like, yeah, Cordry's being a douche, but man, is he a funny and likable douche. And then let's go from the end of the world
party. Speaking of that party.
Speaking of the party, what is this week's junk food pairing, Brian?
This week's junk food pairing is also forever now my Patton Oswalt impression, which is he's at a party and he's talking with Steve Carell and just talking about how the end of the world is making women so horny and that guys can really outkick their coverage and get women who are way out of their league. And Steve Carell in this scene has been set up with Melanie Lynskey, who is so fucking adorable in this movie.
Yeah. Comes to the party dressed in everything she never got to wear.
Which, by the way, I felt like it was a missed opportunity, because when I first saw that, I'm like, oh, she's been looting. I was like, that's got to be a reference to the looting, right? And it's like, no, but okay. But I think this is what prompted my fiance to call him such a sad sack, because he just can't like get excited about the fact that she's like super into him and she's so fucking cute. But at one point, Patton Oswalt's telling Steve Carell all this and he looks over at Melanie Lynskey and he's just like, that is a work of art. Do you want to
double stuff that cookie?
Do you want to double stuff that cookie with me? And it's just like, he just keeps doing it and is like,
and he starts singing it.
Do you want to double stuff that cookie?
That joke always fucking floors me. It's so fucking funny.
And the way
Patton delivers it is so fucking funny.
So double stuff Oreos.
Of course. I knew that when I set this week up, I'm like, he's going to want to do double stuffed Oreos as the junk food.
First of all,
I'm going to be disappointed.
I would greatly appreciate it if you don't refer to it as doing double stuffed Oreos. Let's just eat some double stuffed Oreos and watch Lorene Scafaria movies.
Brian, do you want to double stuff that cookie with me?
I don't.
Do you want to double stuff that cookie with me?
I want to end the show. Thanks everybody for joining us on the rebirth of the modern junk food master.
We're going to skip it for JCV December, but the plan is once a month, we want to talk about modern junk food masters again. And so we're kicking it off again. I have somebody controversial in mind for January. So I'm very interested in seeing if I can pull that off with Brian or not.
We'll see.
We'll see if you hate me for even mentioning it or not, but so this has been, I'm so glad I've been wanting to do this episode for a year now. Actually, it is a year that I was like, I want to do an episode on these three films together, and so I'm so happy that we finally got to do it. And please, for the love of God, if you haven't watched one of these movies, fucking watch them. They're so fucking good.
That is the magic of Cargill Vember. If you would like to hear more of our episodes, regardless of whose Vember it is, you can get our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Blog Talk Radio. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. If you really like the show, again, just please go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. You get a lot of great stuff for our patrons, and we so appreciate you guys financially supporting the show. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Well, before we go there, just want to say that's where you can get extra content. We do an extra thing a week, and we're starting up something new. We're starting up the Deep Dish.
The Deep Dish.
Which is, for those of you that want a whole extra episode, one more episode a month of Junk Food Cinema, we're going to give you one episode a month.
Of the real B-sides. The stuff that, talk about stuff that maybe you hadn't seen, you didn't catch, maybe you didn't even hear about. This is the show where we are going to do the real deep dives. Like, we are going to find the stuff that we love that you're going to be like, what the fuck is that genre you're even talking
about?
And
not only that, is the stuff that you're going to have to track down to watch with us.
Yeah.
Stuff that, you know, it only exists on a UK import, or you have to find it on VHS, or you're going to have to watch a YouTube rip of it, because frankly, it's the stuff we can't talk about every week because people would be like, guys, the only way to watch, like, I really, really, really want to do a full episode on Skate Town USA eventually, but the only way to watch it is in one of a handful of 35 millimeter prints that exist, or watching a shitty YouTube rip of a 16 millimeter print of that movie. And so we doing an episode on it is unfair, because you guys would be like, yeah, we listen to you talk about for an hour about a mythical movie that we can't watch. So this is where we're going to do that.
Oh, this is where I'll talk about the movie I discovered a few months ago that is a late 80s, early 90s Italian Aliens ripoff that is so fucking, like, it may be the most brazen of any of the ripoffs I've ever seen, and that is fucking saying something.
And so that's where we're going to do the it started as we were going to do the deep cut, and of course we're Junk Food Cinema, so it's the deep dish.
100%. It's cinematic archaeology that we're assigning to you, so that'll be part of the fun. And that
over on our Patreon.
Yeah.
So, where you can find me on Twitter and Instagram, at Massawyrm, M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M. And you can find my book, Sea of Rust, on audible.com for your audiobook needs, and wherever you buy books for the hard copy.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at Bri Guy Salisbury, and you can find my Facebook page, facebook.com/Brian Salisbury Critic. And yeah, I'm going to end the show by letting you know that if the world does happen to end, just make sure you leave your mark on the world with a lot of good deeds, a lot of good friends, and an amazing fucking playlist, because in the end, that is our economy.